sorry we didn't have the Bud Friedman album.
Oh, this was a fine album. Who is this?
Marion and Jimmy McPartland.
McPartland.
Yeah, I gave you the Buddy Hackett, and if you can find something on that, maybe a little later.
On that. I don't ordinarily work to Dixie. This is kind of a... Actually, this isn't Dixie. This is Chicago. Chicago.
The one that you just played was Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago. Yeah. So is this... Hackett, too.
It is Chicago?
Matter of fact, they recorded it on Melrose Avenue, it says.
That's Chicago.
That sure is Chicago.
You know, I've told Candy a lot of the stories about things that happened when we were at WOR together. One story I've told her, but certainly not in the great detail that you're in a position to tell the story. Herb Salzman, who is a general manager now of WOR, he was a man who always had some ideas to increase sales. He's really sales-oriented, not as much program-oriented as he is sales-oriented. And this happens in this business. The general manager can be really a former program director or a former sales manager. And certainly we all have admiration for Herb Salzman. But one particular time, and I'm not going to blow the story because I just want to lead into it. And I'd had many of these experiences, but Gene Shepherd was going to be a judge of a beauty contest. And a limousine is picking him up about 7 o'clock, a Smith's limousine, to take him out to this theater where he's going to appear in person. He's a celebrity, a big name, no doubt. Hundreds of people will be turned away because Gene will be there to select the beauty of that neighborhood. It was a very, very hot day. June or July of that particular year, Gene is standing in front of 1440 Broadway in all of his splendor. It is still daylight saving time. The sun is just gradually fading away, and the limousine is about 10 minutes late already.
And I stood around and looked up and down the street. See, I'm expecting this limousine. I'm looking for a Cadillac or at least a Lincoln. And it's getting hotter and hotter, later and later. And I realized that at 7 o'clock, I'm supposed to be there. That's when the beauty queens were going to make their big appearance. And I was going to judge them along with several other eminent New Yorkers. Incidentally, Candy, have you ever appeared yourself in a beauty contest?
Mm-hmm.
It's a curious experience to be sitting there, to be sitting in judgment. Because
mm-hmm.
beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I'll tell you what I found out about it that night. It's getting hotter and hotter, and I got a little desperate. See, so I finally figured, well, something's going wrong here. And, you know, there's a certain thing you get involved in.
Wasn't it Kirsch Beverage sponsoring it?
Okay.
No, I guess it was some other...
I don't think it was.
No, that's right.
With somebody else.
Good.
Yes.
But it was... I don't recall who sponsored it, actually, to be honest with you. It was such a hellish experience that night that it's almost like a Freudian erasure. You know, you erase certain things that are happening to you, even as they're happening. Your mind keeps like a tape recorder. You've got it on erase. And it's getting hotter and hotter. And have you ever been involved in a thing which was given to you it was going to be a grand experience. You know, it's going to be very elegant. Everything's going to be very show, theater, theatrical, and elegant. And I was kind of looking forward to this for about 2 or 3 days. But at this moment, I had a faint premonition, faint inkling, that something was not quite right. And man is a creature of great instincts. He doesn't even have to understand them. I know that at this moment, I thought, uh-oh, something's going on. And I went back into the station, saying, well, I better call, because it's already now about 6:45. about 20 minutes to 7, so he's going to wait. He's supposed to pick me up about 6:15. And I've been waiting down in front of this place for all this time, the people walking by, and traffic is thinning out. So I run back upstairs, and I call Mr. Saltzman. And I get him on the phone. He says, you mean they're not there yet? And I says, no, there's nobody there yet. He says, well, you go down and wait. He says, no, don't, we're counting on you. He says, you know, they really need you out there. It's going to be a big event. And I said, well, gosh, what am I doing? He says, well, you go down and wait. He says, they'll be there. So I go down and I wait on the curb. I'm there about 5 minutes. And I notice parked over by a fire hydrant about a 1953 Dodge that had seen much better times. In fact, this Dodge, I could see the left rear spring was broken. There's several large dings on it. Somebody's written a well-known Anglo-Saxon four-letter word in the dust on the rear trunk. And this guy gets out, and he walks over towards me, and he says, hey, he said, so you are around here? I says, yes. You know, I'd never heard of anybody mugging a whole radio station. Yes, they're here and they're armed. Is this guy named Shepard around here? I says, yes. My worst fears had been realized. I was being picked up. The guy says, I'm supposed to pick you up. I says, oh, you are? Yep. He says, hurry up, we're late. So I said, yes, we are. I said, where have you been? He said, I've been waiting around the corner. I says, well, I was told to meet you here. Yeah, but it's no parking here. I says, yes, it is. And so we got in the car. I got in the back seat, and it was, you know, I tried to pretend it was still a limousine, you know, the back seat of this 53 Dodge Coronet. And I sat down, and springs were coming out of the seats, I was sitting there, I had a tasty collection of old Rheingold cans in the back there, and up around my ankles, you know, a couple of cigar butts, and we took off. And we headed downtown, see? And so here we are, and I'm thinking to myself, and incidentally, I have to point out something very salient at this very important point. I am wearing a rented tuxedo. Which added a certain panache to the whole fair. And here I am, it's broad daylight, and I'm riding in the back seat of a 53 Dodge, which had been battered and torn from pillar to post, and I'm riding down, and people are looking in. You know, we'd stop at a stoplight, guys would look in there, I'm sitting there with I had a maroon tie that had clipped on my shirt, collar, and I'm beginning to sweat through it. And by the way, there was a little scene at the station about who was going to pay for the rented tuxedo. Started the whole thing off on a happy note. So we're driving downtown. I figure, you know, everything's under control. So we arrived down on some obscure bridge down way down on the far end of Manhattan. And we start across the bridge. When all of a sudden, we're riding in the middle of traffic, the guy hollers over the roar. He had bad tappets in his car, by the way. You couldn't hear anything. And it was one of these cars, you know, that has a muffler that hits a certain resonant frequency. Have you ever been in a car where the muffler's going, and you're hollering over the, you know, the muffler, and he hollers. He said, hey, where are we going? He doesn't know where we're going. I says, well, you're going to take me where the beauty contest is. He said, where the hell's that? I says, well, it's gotta be over there somewhere, over there, towards Queens. He says, well, he says, we better find out because we're gonna get in the traffic down there by the end of the street. So I'm getting frantic. So we get off the bridge, and at that point I says, well, I better make a call, find out where this place is. At this point he does not know where. He's been told by whoever he works for, just come and pick this guy up. And he was somebody's brother-in-law, by the way. Everybody in Queens is somebody's brother-in-law. So we stop at the light. I said, wait a minute. So I went into a Shell station wearing a rented tuxedo. Jump out of this 53 Dodge trying to look like Fred Astaire. It ain't easy when you're in this old tin canyon. I did run into horses who jumped over the grease pitch, you know, and I ran into the Shell station. I says, "Where's the phone?" And the guy looks up and he's sitting there, you know, he's drinking a Pepsi or something. He looks up and he says, "What the hell?" He says, "Where's the wedding, buddy?" And he's wham, aha, yuck, yuck. I said, "Well, I want the phone. I don't want any jokes. Give me the phone." And he says, "Over there." So I go over to the phone, you know, it's one of these greasy phones that you have in gas stations, you know, with names written all over it, said Marie, you know, and all great numbers to call. So, you know, I figured at that point I'm just going to give up the whole damn thing and call Marie and go wherever she is. Spend the night in my tuxedo. Never come back. When you think of the things you have to do, we're going to have to answer for a lot when we get up before the bar of justice time. So I called Herb again. The gracious old judge says, "Herb." And he says, Why aren't you at the company? I says, "Herb, I'm over here at the other end of some bridge in a Shell station. Where is this place?" And he says, "What do you mean?" I says, What's the name of the place? Where is the theater? What? "You mean you don't know?" I says, "I don't, Herb." He says, "When did I?" He says, "Don't leave the phone. I'll find out." So at that point, he hangs up. Now I'm standing in the Shell station next to a payphone, wearing a red tuxedo, and people keep driving in and looking at me. In those days, they had gas in Shell stations, you know, and people would come in. They'd drive in, and it was a little station made out of bricks, it looked like, and you can't hide, you know. I'm standing right above a grease pit, and this guy kept hollering out, "Will you get on the ball? I can't wait all day, you know. My wife's waiting for supper." Well, I'm standing there waiting, and then the phone rings. Oh, I pick up the phone. The guy says, "Is Ernie there?" I says, "Well, wait a minute, I'll get Ernie." I says, "Are you Ernie?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Okay, tell him, is that Jaime?" I says, "Are you Jaime?" He says, "Yeah." I says, "Tell him to wait." Jaime, wait. And you know, it had a certain surreal quality to wearing that tuxedo answering the phone of the Shell station. Oh, God, you know. Well, Jaime and Ernie, they were on the phone about 20 minutes. And finally, Ernie hangs up and says, "Thanks for answering. He says, if it calls back, tell him I'm gone." I said, "Okay." So I'm waiting more by the phone. By this time, he's used to me, you know. And he asks me if I want a cigarette, you know, when I'm eating a sandwich with him. So finally, the phone rings again, and it's Herb. Herb says, he says, "Okay, I got the place." He said, "Waiting for you." I said, "All right, Herb, where is it?" He says, "Well, it's the, wait a minute, I wrote it down here. It's the Little Bijou." He says, "On East Queens Boulevard, just off 129th Street, between 129th and 138th Street," he says, "under the L." I says, "Okay, Little Bijou, East Queens Boulevard, just off 129th Street. So I go back into the car. I says, "Take me to the Little Bijou, my good man." He's really bummed by this time. This guy's sitting there smoldering. Looks at me. He's been running out of the car every 5 minutes while he's been waiting, running across the street to a place called the Bluebird. He ain't been drinking Rheingold, I can tell. That's for starters, nor Kirsch. And he comes back in, and he sits there, and he says, "Where do you want to go?" I says, "Take me to the Little Bijou Theater." "What the hell's that?" I said, "Well, it's off East Queens Boulevard between 129th and 130th Street. It's under the L, stupid." He says, "Okay, all right, I'll take it." He said, "Put in it first." We start going down the street. It's now, by the way, about 7:45. I was supposed to be there at 7. And have you ever been involved in something that has gone so disastrous that now you're beginning to enjoy it? You know? And it's just like guys get to enjoy wars after a while. You know, I'm sitting in the back seat, sitting around counting the gum wrappers, around, and we go up and down side streets. It's now 7:45, and sure enough, we finally pull up before one of the saddest little neighborhood theaters, and I'd been expecting something. I had elegance, you know, the Roxy or something. Here's this little theater next to a meat market. And would you believe it or not, on the marquee, they had Beauty Contest Tonight, and it says, WNEW star Dick Shepherd appearing in person. Well, I knew it had to happen. And incidentally, this theater was so sad that the other side they shared with the meat market. It's the bacon, 79 cents a pound, you know, on the marquee. So I walk up to the lady, and said, there's a little old lady sitting in the box office. And I says, I'm Dick Shepherd from WNEW. By now, I'm going to go with it. So she says, oh, they've been waiting for you. And I said, yeah, well, all right. I says, what do you do? She says, well, we go right in. So I walk into the theater. And if I have ever seen a scene which haunts me, comes back, like have you ever had a bag of slightly bad potato chips? They tend to taste them for weeks. Well, this scene is like that. I've walked into the theater, and you know, these old theaters have a real smell to them. I mean, the seats are thick with ancient gum. I mean, there was gum in the bottom of those seats that had been chewed and popped by teenagers when Rudolph Valentino was taking a screen test, you know. There it was. You could smell cigar butts and tennis shoes and everything. And I walk in this theater, and there's about, outside, maybe 75 people scattered around the house. And I'm wearing a tuxedo. And I stop by the door. There's a guy standing there taking tickets. I says, when is the beauty contest? He says, what do you want to know? You an inspector? I says, no, I'm not an inspector. I'm going to judge the beauty contest. Oh. He says, okay. He says, just a minute. He says, I'll get Al. I wait in the darkness, and I could see this flickering image on the screen. They were looking at an ancient Chester Morris movie or something up there. And I'm waiting, and the guy suddenly appears out of darkness. He says, hey, you Shepherd? I says, yeah. He says, okay, let's go. He says, follow me. He grabs a hold of my coat, and we run through the darkness, and now we're backstage. You ever been backstage of a neighborhood theater in Queens? Fantastic. Old, battered popcorn machines are sitting back there, you know. Ancient stars of that theater, and there's about 9 girls waiting to go on. And I arrive with my tuxedo, and these girls are all nervous, and they're wearing bathing suits, and Alexander's Best. And they're all waiting, and I have never seen a collection. I formed an idea that night. The people who are drawn to beauty contests either are beauties or they're totally the opposite. It's just like, if you ever sat in at an announcer's audition? Well, out of 10 guys that walk in, 5 have pronounced speech defects. If you notice that, I mean, really. I remember one guy auditioning in an audition that I sat in on for a staff announcer who was to do station breaks, and he couldn't pronounce W. I'm serious. He would say, Kerbal, you. The one thing an announcer has to say is W. He could say B or C, but he couldn't say W. He said, Kerbal, you. And the name of the station was WLW. Can you imagine this? So this is... His two short little fat girls would look like cantaloupes with feet. And there was another one that looked exactly like a hat rack. You've never seen a hat rack wearing Band-Aids, And you know, one was amazing. Well, one girl, did you ever watch Dick, did you ever read Dick Tracy?
Yeah.
One girl looked exactly like the mole. The character that had a long, narrow face with a mustache on the end. And Well, with that, Al walks out on the stage. He's got a checkered coat, and all of a sudden they turn the film off, and on comes the light, and he's out there with this double button carbon mic. Well, it was a collector's item, you know.
He says, "Ladies and gentlemen," he says, "time now for the first semifinal of our great beauty contest. We have beauties from all over Queens have assembled here tonight. And to judge, we have Dick Shepherd from WNEW. Here he is, Dick Shepherd."
And I walk out of the stage and you hear a murmur of angry muttering. You know? And I walk back off the stage. And the other two guys are introduced. By the way, one of them has gone on to become one of the most famous talk show. He was there, too, the three of us. All badly introduced. And Al says, "Okay," he says, "now our guests are going to sit in the front row and they're going to judge the beauties." So we sat down in the front with three of us wearing tuxedos. And with that, they put on a record. I mean, everything was done with exquisite slob taste. You know, that's a talent. I must say, slob art is a talent. And on through the PA system played on this crystal pickup, John, with fantastic hiss. It sounded like Wayne King. I mean, I thought Wayne King records had dissolved millions of years ago. On came Wayne King and his golden saxophone playing, "A pretty girl is like a melody." And he's nine girls walked out on the stage. Again, the slob art technique was at its fullest. They had a lime green light. This is the very light that Bela Lugosi used in playing Dracula to such effect. And these girls came out, they looked unbelievable. They looked like, you know, that they had been resurrected. And there they were on the stage. With that, the audience starts to holler, "Woo!" And they were sitting there, and these poor girls were walking back and forth, and Al says, "Now, here is Carmelita Glockenspiel, 129th Street and 4th Avenue. Give Carmelita a big hand." And about three guys clapping. I'm sitting down here, and we're supposed to be making notes. And I turned to the guy next to me, who is, as I said, now a famous...
You don't want to mention
names. I do not want to mention names. I says, "Johnny," he says, "yeah." I says, "how the hell do we get out of this?" He says, "I know what I'm going to do." He says, "I'm going to fill out the form and run like hell." I says, "what I'm going to do, too." And so we sat there in the darkness, we're filling out our forms. It was academic as to who was the most beautiful. And, you know, I said, "hey, Johnny, I'm going to vote for the hat rack." He says, "I'm going all the way with the alligator." So, we turned in our three ballots, and it was a dead heat between three people. The alligator, the mole, and the hat rat. So they went on into the semifinal. There was a great roar of applause. You know, the 75 assembled people. Back out in that 53 Dodge. And this time I'm with Johnny and with this other guy, a guy named Mel. We drove under the L, and we headed back to Manhattan. Dead silence. And I said to the guy who was driving, I says, "wait a minute." I says, "I want to make a phone call. Stop right here at the Shell station." I walked in, and here's Ernie sitting there. He says, "hey," he says, "how are you?" He says, "how was the wedding?" I said, "went off fine." I said, "let me use the phone again." So I called up Herb, and I said, "Herb?" He says, "yeah." I said, "Herb," I said, "I did it." He says, "how was it? Was it exciting? Boy, you guys live a great life, watching all those girls and all that stuff." I said, "Herb, I'm going to send you out on the next one." I said, "I'll tell you one thing. The alligator won." So you'll be seeing her picture in the subways. Semi-final winner. I hung up. And I've never forgotten that night because it had so many elements of surreal Nathaniel West. And from that time on, Herb and I have never mentioned it.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Then the night, then the time I was sent out to the, I'll never forget the time I was sent out. You go through some unbelievably embarrassing moments in showbiz. Like the night I was sent out, this was some time ago, to the opening of a supermarket out in Jersey. And I arrived. They told me, you know, they really want you out there. The whole thing. So I arrived out at the supermarket. Were you involved in that one, John?
Yes, I went to...
And the guy didn't know who we were.
Yeah, well, we were out there. No, I went out with Mr. Salzman in his convertible. And I had a bar mitzvah suit on to make a good appearance. And so Salzman is confused. He's driving around. And they're constructing a new food fair store. The glasses in the windows and shelves are being installed. And if we waited for the grand opening, it would have been about 6 weeks later. So he inquired, and we found out we were not coming to the grand opening of a supermarket. We were supposed to be at another food fair, which was like 2 miles down the line, that was celebrating their first anniversary. So we got to this shopping area, and I would say maybe there were about 30 or 40 cars there, but not for food fair. Possibly the manager of the food fair's car was there, and some of the other merchants who were opening their stores at that time. Well, I saw these big signs on the window, lamb chops, 79 cents a pound, and a couple of other things like that. I didn't notice anything about Long John appearing there in person. So now, Salton says, don't worry, it's all set.
It'll be a big deal.
Big, big reception, and I didn't want to make this scene at all. So now when we walk over to the entrance of the store, there's a little 8.5 by 11 card, which was an advertisement for something on one side, but they had turned it over so they had the back, and then crayon, they said, Long John will appear here Tuesday at 10 o'clock. It was the same type of sign that it gives you the manager's name in case of an emergency call. So I walk in, and there's about six women with shopping carts and curlers in their hairs, in their hair. And the manager is called, and he comes over, and he gives me a double warm handshake. Both hands he clasps my hand, and he shakes it graciously and firmly. And he said, we're really delighted to have you here. And he said, I was talking to my wife at dinner last night, and she was saying that you are so different from other broadcasters. Well, at least I knew I had one fan. And my wife said to me, your choice of music that you play on your show is so great. And my wife listens to you every night at 8 o'clock. Of course, I'm on at midnight and never played any music. It's a talk show. So now he tells me that I should walk around and talk to the people with their shopping carts. And Salzman is sort of hiding, you know, in the shadows of the door there because he knows we're really bombing out. Now, I said to Salzman, and I went to him, I said, what do you want me to say? He said, just say, I'm Long John. How are you? And I did this to about four women. And it didn't impress them at all. One woman asked me where the Les Toil was. You know, I guess she thought I was the new assistant manager or something. Now, when we're ready to leave, which was around 12 minutes later, the manager thanked me for helping to make this celebration of the first year that they've been in business a great success. And he had a little gift for me. And he said, I know you possibly enjoy great steaks. These are our best And these are 98 cents a pound or something like that. And he had two steaks wrapped up, and I said, no, no, thank you. Salton said, I'll take them for you, Jumbo. And that was the end of our tour.
Well, you know, it's funny, Candy. I see this is I don't know whether you've ever had any of those fantastically humiliating things, but it isn't only in you might say broadcasting. It's all areas. Like last year, I was out in Albuquerque, and I was there for a specific reason, obviously, and I was with some people, and we went into a drive-in, mm-hmm. Like a McDonald's. And, you know, there's people driving in and out. I go into the McDonald's with the guy to get a couple of quarter pounders, and I see this guy sort of looking furtive, standing over in the corner there, saying, I walked over and got in line and waiting for the quarter pounders, and I turned to him. He looked for me, and I said, say, don't I know you? And he said, well, I don't know. He looks away, and I says, hey, of course. I said, you're Anthony Quinn. I said, what the hell are you doing here? He said, well, I'm supposed to be signing autographs.
How he ever got sent to a McDonald's, I have no idea, but it was for some cockamamie movie that they were premiering there, and somebody got a half-baked idea that Johnson's bombed out, and there he is, stuck. Well, then I'll add it to another one. One day I'm down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, Fort Lauderdale is, have you ever been down there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, it's a federal highway. It's a great big highway that runs right along through there. And
number one.
Yeah, it's a big highway, and I needed something for the car that I was driving. It was a great big discount house there. Like, it looked like, was Kmart. You know, you remember the Kmart? These are big discount houses, gigantic buildings. They look like airplane hangars.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into this Kmart, 50 million cars in the driveway. And I walk into the place, and I go all the way in the back where there's something, tire jacks and, you know, stuff like that, you know, the lawnmower sharpeners and all kinds of junk back there. And they had sporting equipment, all of the people wandering around. And there's a guy standing next to the counter there. And he's just sort of standing, look kind of sheepish, you know, big, huge guy. And I walk up to him. And he says, do you like an autograph? I was going to ask him where the spark plugs were. I says, well, no, I hadn't come in for an autograph. I said, if you're giving them out, you know, what the hell, you know? Oh, yeah. He looks kind of sheepish. He says, what do you want me to autograph? I says, well, I don't care. You know, if I had a cast, you could autograph that. But so, but what he got? I said, well, I had a paper, the Fort Lauderdale News. And so I said, yeah, you can autograph this. He said, all right. So he writes down Frank Howard, Washington Senators. You know, Frank Howard, the famous home run hitter. See? So I says, Frank Howard, you're Frank Howard. And he says, yeah. He said, they sent me over here to sign autographs. I says, but nobody's here. He says, why? He says, I'll only be here another half hour. And I says, oh, God, you know, the humiliation. Here's a guy, you know, the $100,000 a year ball player, and he's got to stand around in some discount house.
Mm. I had one experience at Bookmasters. Next to, I think it was the George M. Cohan Theater. And Bookmasters at that time was open all night. And the first book that I wrote was now out in paperback. And I was supposed to go there. Well, it was one of the worst snowstorms. In fact, it was so bad that they couldn't even keep the doors shut. And they had a card table there in the front. And I walked over there with, I don't know, Paris Flamand or somebody like that. And there's no one on the street, and there's no one in the store. But they have a tremendous supply of my new paperback, 6, which are there to be autographed. Well, I sat there freezing cold, and I have to get back to WOR, which is a short distance, but it would take a good 15 minutes to walk back because of the snowstorm.
And eventually, a little elderly lady who should have never been out in that storm comes in. She didn't have to open the door. The wind did it for her. And I am sitting there, freezing cold. Snow, even on my card table by now, that had drifted in. And she said, "Are you Long John?" I said, "Yes, I am." It's the only person who came in and asked for me. They did have a rather small sign. It was larger than at the supermarket. It was about 11 by 14 stuck in the corner of the window. And she said, "Can I look at the book?" And she did. I thought she was reading the entire book, but she didn't quite complete it. And I said, "Well, I have to leave. Do you want to get one? Do you want an autograph?" She said, "No, I just wanted to see what you look like." And she thanked me very much, and she disappeared into the night out in a snowstorm. And I disappeared, and the manager, no one came over, no one said a word, and Paris and I, through the slushy snow and all, went back to WOR. Not one single autograph was given for one of the books.
Well, one time down in Richmond, Virginia, there was a book author dinner. You've heard of book author dinner.
Many of
them. Right. And at this particular one, Philip Wiley, the late Philip Wiley, was one of the authors. And the daughter of Marcus Child, whose first name I can't recall, but she had a book out, and myself were to appear in the local bookstore. And they had a big hoodinky before the dinner that night and a cocktail party and so forth. And we went in, and with the exception of the salespeople, no one. And they had signs. They had a great big tent sort of thing standing outside, a placard, you know, this type of thing. And I noticed that Phil Wiley sat down at a table, and we each had our own table with books piled up, and he sat down and immediately started writing, except there's nobody in the store, he's autographing. And I learned a lesson from that particular thing. Anytime you go into a store for an autographing party or a book appearance, you immediately sign. And I went over to see what he was writing because I couldn't see any people. There weren't any. He was writing Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, Happy Birthday. And he left space for the name of the person, Philip Wiley. Well, with the autograph in the book, the store cannot send the books back to the publisher.
Yeah, that's true. It's already got stock, yeah.
So that we all got the same message, and we all sat there, and I think maybe there were three books sold, and I think they were Phil Wiley's the whole afternoon, but we signed those books fast and furiously.
Well, I've had a lot of good experiences, though, in book signings. I just had one. Yeah, I've really had some big ones. I had, in fact, I remember probably the most successful book signing that I've ever been involved in was at Wanamaker's in Philadelphia. We had about...
I've done that one, too.
About 1,500 yeah. people there.
They have the lunch for you first.
Yeah.
Upstairs in the...
very well done.
Executive dining room.
That's right. I guess a lot of stores don't realize that you have to produce a book signing just like you produce a show. You have to really put it on.
What's the fellow's name there? Weatherby? Or...
Yeah, he's the manager.
Yeah, he's right. the man who handles them. Great man.
Right.
Handles
very bad,
very, very well.
If your publisher, and if the books come from the PR department, if someone in that department might happen to forget to send the books, it's rather embarrassing.
You know, that's one of the biggest problems today in publishing is distribution.
I believe that. I've had that happen time and again.
And it's a tough problem because all over the country, now Wanda Hickey has just come out in paperback, and Dell is one of the biggest paperback publishers. And yet, I get letters from people. I've gotten letters already saying, I live in X city, and they haven't got your book. They can't find it, and they never heard of it.
Think of going to a publishing party for your own book. I mean, an autographing party, and they don't even have the book.
That's happened to me. It happened to me in Seattle. We had a very bad situation where I was sent out to Seattle by Doubleday. This is when In God We Trust came out. Now, that was a bestseller, Candy, on the bestseller list for, 17 weeks, national. And really legitimate. You know, every book today is called a bestseller. You pick up, every ad says the bestseller about to be published. They didn't call them bestsellers before they even out.
About to be.
Yeah, that's right. They say that. But actually, there's only a few books that actually make the national list. For example, Wanda Hickey here was on the Time Magazine bestseller list, which is a national list, one of the most difficult to make.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I got out to, here I was on the bestseller list at that time, but In God We Trust. We were already in our sixth or seventh edition. And I arrived out at the airport. It was a real strange moment, and this woman met me at the airport, and she said, I'm represent the University of Washington here, and she said, we were going to have a big party for you here, but we can't get any copies of your book. She says, I have the only copy in town. And I said, where'd you get it? She said, well, I had to go to Portland to get it. And so we went to the TV station. I was in the bed on TV, and here I was being interviewed by a guy on an hour show. Very embarrassing. He didn't have a copy of the book.
Mm.
And I wonder how many people realize that books are difficult to distribute. And in fact, one of the reasons is that most bookstores today are in the Snoopy sweatshirt business.
Mm-hmm.
The books are a sideline now in most books.
And posters.
Posters, they sell Lucy note paper.
Calendars.
Charles Schulz is an entire industry now. He's taken over, way in the back in the book department, after you pass the Big Daddy Banana Pick pens and stuff, you may find a few symbolic books.
One thing is that, are you doing something?
I do have to. I'm a little late on that.
Okay.
And we are back here again. This is the Long John Neville Candy Jones Show, and our guest tonight is Gene Shepherd.
You know, I really enjoy this, John. I like to just sit around and, as you say, cut up a melon.
That's right.
This kind of radio is, to me, very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And I
we
think the listeners
it.
Like it, too.
We enjoy it very, very much. I think after a little while, we will open the phones for...
Do you slice up any melons anymore these days?
Yeah, we cut up a few jackpots. like last night, this man, Nick Kendall. Kendall, rather, who was doing a story, was just sitting here. He had been interviewing me for, I guess, some 20 or 30 minutes before. And we had Bob Carson on and David Schulte. And somehow there was an opportunity to throw him in an empty chair. And he participated and kind of enjoyed it and got a little feeling of a taste of the flavor of the show, which is pretty hard to get if you're sitting on the sideline or listening at home. You really don't know what happens and how the whole thing goes. Yes.
But he had said he had been a broadcaster and in television.
In the Orient.
Yeah.
Yes. He had been for 12 years in the Orient.
No, in Hong Kong. Excuse me, yes. I had just said in Japan, but it was in Hong Kong.
John, have you worked the Buddha Gaff recently?
No, I haven't. For a number of years. My last appearance was in Hammond, Indiana.
Have you, have you used the Punkum Gaff at all?
No.
Flukum.
Flukum. No. No, I've...
Knew that John invented a razor sharpener?
A razor sharpener?
Yes, he did. There was a moment when it was Tap City with John. And as you know, John is a man of exceeding resources.
Right.
Fantastic. Trapping John is about like trapping a water rat. He can swim, he can run, he can bite, he can do anything. And John was Tap City in a second-rate hotel here in New York. And really down on his uppers.
Like a fourth-rate.
Fourth-rate hotel.
I gradually worked up to the second.
He was wearing the Daily News editorial page at the soles of his shoes. And he's sitting there right up against the wall, and he's looking bleakly around the room, trying to figure out how he can eke a dollar out of this world. And he notices hanging in the closet some empty coat hangers.
Wire coat hangers.
Empty wire coat hangers. And, of course, that's about all John ever had in his closets in those days. And he got an idea. So he went downstairs, and he had maybe 35 cents in his pocket. Went down to one of these places where they sell all kinds of novelties and so on, and he bought himself a bag of marbles. Marbles, glass marbles. And he came back to the hotel room with a pair of pliers, and 15 minutes later, John had created 25 razor sharpeners using bent wire coat hangers and marbles. And five minutes later, he's down on 14th Street hawking them at a dollar a clip. And within 25 minutes, John has made $74, packed his little bag, and departed for Charleston, West Virginia. I'm telling you the truth.
But how did the marble thing
work? Well, John took two marbles. He took two marbles, and you take the wire coat hanger, and you make two little hooks like circles, see, and you fit the marbles in together so the marbles are just touching.
Yeah.
And the coat hangers hold them together.
Yeah.
At which point, then, you take a double-edged razor blade and you run it between the marbles.
And it works?
You're darn right it works.
I'll be darned.
The police department took a dim view of it.
He had many friends. I've heard about the mendicant squad.
Yes,
he had many friends in the mendicant squad.
Well, they come in here occasionally today and see whether John is running a gap.
They come in as a guest.
The idea of John sitting in a hotel room dreaming up a concept like that, you know.
Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, and then the time John invented the... did he ever tell you about the time he invented the beauty cream?
The beauty cream, no.
Oh, yeah.
I wish he had. I'd like to use it.
Well, you wouldn't exactly like to use this beauty cream, but it turned a nice buck for John, and he, again, it was a hotel room situation that developed outside of Atlantic City. And John is sitting there, and it was Tap City. There it is. John brought in one of his... he brought one of them in.
I've never seen it.
Well, I had to get... if I couldn't have found it, I'd have been disappointed.
Fantastic, John. He brought
in one of them. What happened was a lady who was a fan of the show, as a joke, sent it back to me for a refund. She realized
it's a lifetime guarantee John offered this.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the outcome of it is I sent her my check for 25 cents, and I understand she has it framed.
Isn't that something?
Now, eventually, I had a patent pending on it, and then I went to a wire company and had them make it. I used to do this by hand, twisting this with a long-nosed plier. And, of course, I hadn't selected the marbles. I'd just buy a bag of marbles.
Yeah, they'd come in any color.
Yeah, and so they were a mixture. Then when you get a real tough day, you would work some for a half a dollar by selecting the color of the marbles. This is for super sharp.
The green ones were they were the ones that
really... That's right,
yeah.
That's right. There it is.
Oh, my. There is such a thing, and it's beautiful.
We're not kidding you, Candy.
Well, no. These are not...
And it really works.
These are not apocryphal, are they, Jim?
No, they're all based on fact. And I was fiddling around trying to figure how. Then I made a form. I think it was a piece of 2x4, and I can't think of the type of the nail. It doesn't have a head on, headless nail. Finishing nails, right?
Yeah, finishing nails.
Finishing
right.
Nails. So I got, I forget what pound weight, whether they were 10 penny or what, but they had to be strong. And I made a design, and I would put my wire, and of course I didn't have money for wire after I made my first one, so I had to take... The wire that I had, and that's pretty tough to bend.
That's coat hanger.
The coat hanger wire. So then I would start it like here, I forget, and then I would follow around and bend it around these very, maybe I'm wrong when I say 10 penny, but they were real heavy finishing nails. so I could slip the whole thing off. Now, if it had a head, I'd have to bend it out of shape again and put it back in shape. And I used to make these and knock out maybe at night about maybe 24. That's all I could produce. And
assembly line up in hotel room number 12.
That's right, in the old Carmack Hotel. It was a great place. They had hot and cold running water, and you were very fortunate because you would always have cold water out of both faucets. But in order, of course, if you were washing your hands, you would always use the one marked H because it gave you a sensation that it was, but it wasn't. It was just the same water. I'd wash my hands.
We're up here at this moment.
Then rinse with cold water.
Candy, you know, you strike me as a girl who lived a somewhat elegant life. And I can only say that living as John has done and as I have done in a two-bit theatrical hotel in the Times Square area for roughly a year will teach you more than you can learn in all the combined universities of the world. I remember living in a hotel room for one solid year on 49th Street that had been painted so many times with this battleship gray paint that the walls were like 4 or 5 inches closer to you, just because, and you could see they'd even painted over a dead bat and stuff. Yeah, I'm telling you, unbelievable. I'm telling you the truth. And hanging in the middle of the room was a green cord with a yellow light bulb. That was my entire illumination.
Yeah.
And there was a window. I had a window, but the window was permanently sealed by like 200 years of accumulated dust and crud and God knows what, paint and everything else. And the window was a curious color gray, and it looked out into the air shaft. And at nights, I was really tap city, as John says. I can remember one night going down to the, you know, that drugstore at 49th and, it's 50th and Broad.
The Grays?
No, Walgreens.
No, Grays was down around.
The Walgreens was there.
Yeah, Walgreens, yeah.
And I walked into Walgreens one night. I was so down that I walked in there and I stood in front of the candy counter. And I had a long debate. There were candy bars for 6 cents and they had candy bars for 10 cents. And I was debating whether or not, what the hell, it was Thanksgiving, go all the way. Get a 10-cent. I'm serious. And I bought a 10-cent candy bar. And I remember coming back to that room and looking through this gray glass. And you saw nothing but this damn airship. There was never any, it was not, never daytime, never night there. It was always this gray color. And once in a while, something would whistle past the window. Something going down in the edge of here.
What was it?
It's a beer can or a hand grenade or something going past. And it would land down, and down at the bottom of the air shaft was this accumulated midden heap. You know, an archaeological term would have been started about the time of Diamond Jim Brady. And it was thick, you know. I often wondered if you could just cut this midden heap right in half, you know. And you could trace the whole ages of the American theater right from the, you know, one of Lillian Russell's slippers still smelling of champagne and down in the bottom and all the way up the top. And once in a while, strange things would go through the air shaft. And I'm sitting there one night, and it was about, maybe about 11, 12 o'clock at night, midnight. And that was academic. It was never, you know, night, day was all the same. Well, all of a sudden I hear, whoop, whoop, whoop. Yeah, this was a new sound. Well, there were other sounds that were going on constantly in the halls there, you know. You'd hear the sound of the thud of a blackjack occasionally. Yeah, you really would. And then you'd hear the mysterious scuffle. The occasional cryings in the hall. You know, people would say, yeah, you were. Anyway, you hear a muffled scream. You've been in places like
Holy
that, Jack.
Mm.
And you know, you mind your own counsels. But I heard this oop, oop, oop.
What was it?
Well, that was the question that occurred to me. What was it? See, so I walk out in the hall. I look up and down. It's dark. These halls, but it was totally dark. They had one little red light bulb down at the other end of
the fire exit.
That's all. The fire exit was academic. It was painted on the wall.
If there was ever a fire in there, you went with the car.
There was no door or anything.
No.
Just had the bulb down there. So I hear, oop, oop. So I go downstairs. See, I go down to the desk, and here's Jimmy sitting at the desk. There's always a guy that's been there for, 100 years. He sells everything. I mean, once you get to be a regular, you can buy anything. You know, Arabian slave girls, whatever you want. Jimmy's got it. See, so I said to Jimmy, I said, Jimmy. He said, yes. I said, I'm on the second floor there. I said, there's something in the hall. It's going, oop. He says, oh, that's Oliver. I says, Oliver? He says, yeah. He says, he lets them out usually about this time of the night. And I says, what lets out what? He says, well, go back up there. And he says, and go past room 202 and knock on the door. And he'll let you in. So I says, okay. So I go back up to room 202 and knock on the door. The door opens a little cracks. And the guy looks at me and he says, what do you want? I says, are you Oliver? He says, yeah, what do you want? I says, well, I'm down here at 212. He says, yeah, what do you want? And all of a sudden, I hear back of him, oop, oop. I says, what's the oop, oop? He says, well, that's Jimmy and Fred. I says, Jimmy and Fred? He says, yeah, come on in. He was living with his two seals. He had two trained seals. And
out of work act.
He's an out of work act, and he's got his two seals. See, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he would sneak down to the cafeteria and steal old cabbages and bring them back up and they'd eat them. See, so these two seals, about once or twice a week, they would practice, and the seals would play Columbia, the Gem on the Ocean.
Horns.
Yeah, that's right. And they'd go boop 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 boop, and then once a while. So one weekend, I sat with Jimmy and Fred while Oliver went up to the country to visit his sister, and I babysat the seals. So you learn about life. I mean, it's the kind of stuff Johnny Carson doesn't know. You agree, John?
Oh, yes. Actually, the Kermack Hotel, when I was at the Paramount Theater, the Kermack must have been a pretty good, let's say, second-rate or transient hotel at one time, because they had a magnificent big room downstairs that had been an elegant dining room with mirrors on the wall. And how I became acquainted with it was a guy by the name of Buster Holt, who was a doorman at the Paramount Theater. And he told me that his buddy, who was living with them, they both came out of some small community in Massachusetts, a fellow by the name of Ken Bilson, was practicing banjo. So I, in turn, met this man. Of course, the hotel was really right down at the bottom at the time. So we got permission to use that dining room, which was closed off to everybody, but we had heard about it. And we could work doing this dance routine and playing banjos in front of the mirror so we could practice. It was a great floor. It had a lot of spring in it, and you could get the double and triple taps and things like that. It was just marvelous. And, of course, we had planned to appear at the Palace Theater in its heyday. We didn't. We just continued to sit week after week in the balcony for 35 cents. But we had really planned, although the management of the Palace were unaware of our plans and so naturally never negotiated the contract with us.
Just a matter of...
That's right. A lack of communications. And so we didn't do it.